Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Heck yeah. And this is episode number 86, and we are going to talk about a movie called Midnight in Paris.
Ah, yes. Paris.
Paris, France.
Paris, France. Oh, yeah. Not Paris, Texas.
That's right.
There is one, of course. But I had forgotten until I was rewatching this how much of a star of this Paris itself is.
Yeah. It definitely is. I have never been to Paris. No. Okay. I've never been to Paris, but I really enjoyed the movie.
It's just like the movies, except that nobody's usually playing an accordion in the background. It's just like the movies. I'm telling you.
That's impossible. Wonderful. Surely at the airport, they assign you an accordion player and who follows you everywhere.
When they're handing out the beret and the baguettes.
Exactly.
First time we got off, I've been twice. And the first time was after I'd been married 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. Tom and I went. And we got off the plane, and there had been some terrorist threats, which this was way back when no one in the U.S. would have dreamed of such a thing. Uh-huh. And we get off, and the first thing we see is this 6'5" Frenchman in combat fatigues with a machine gun standing there. And I'm like, this is not what I expected. But after that, it was.
All right. So bring your own accordion is what you're saying.
Yes.
All right.
Yes. Bring your own accordion.
Sounds
and probably
good.
Your beret.
Yeah, this movie was not what I expected. I don't know what I expected. You know, I have not seen many Woody Allen movies.
Really?
I have not. Yeah. Just in fact, I'm trying to even remember if I've seen others.
Oh, Scott.
Yeah. Well, please. You need to give me a short list.
I will easily give you a short list.
Yeah.
And I did realize, though, when I was watching this and we were talking over our favorite Woody Allen movies, that they are not probably movies that other people love necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
It's Radio Days, which he does the voiceover, but it's really about his youth and how the whole family listened to different radio shows and just about their lives growing up. So it's a period piece. Small Time Criminals. He's in it. It's just a comedy. It's hilarious.
Okay.
And Bullets Over Broadway. He's not in it. Also a comedy. And Everyone Says I Love You, which is a musical where he made the stars themselves sing. So Goldie Hawn, you know, all these people, Alan Alda, they're singing.
Nice.
And it's got a certain endearing charm. It's, you know.
Oh,
but
cool.
Woody Allen, I've watched ever since Bananas was not a favorite of mine, but oh gosh, what was the one where he wakes up in the future?
Is it Sleeper?
That's it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think I have seen Sleeper, and I've seen Hannah and Her Sisters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great one. Mm-hmm. And Annie Hall was his big, big one that really put him in the public consciousness way back.
Okay.
And I don't feel like it's aged that well. My husband loved it, especially when it came out.
Okay.
But, you know, he's interesting because he goes back and forth between serious and funny. And we watched an American Masters two-part episode, or, you know, piece on him. And he's got this brown paper bag full of these little pieces of notepaper that he's just jotted down ideas on. And when he's ready to do his next movie, he just dumps it out on the bed and starts looking through the ideas and picks out the ones that kind of strike him at the moment that he maybe could work with.
That's cool.
And the way they've always been able to sell him from, you know, when they were taking him from being a stand-up comedian and screenwriter, part-time screenwriter, to doing movies was, this is a little movie. It'll cost you a couple $1 million. And the studio go, okay, well, we won't lose much. And maybe we'll make something. And so then every so often he'll have these huge movies like Match Point or, you know, actually I think Midnight in Paris was one of those where he makes a fortune, but he's just making his little movies. And now he's so well known that actors will just work for almost nothing to get to work with him.
Wow. Yeah, yeah. On IMDb, it says, yeah, the budget for this movie was $17 million, which is very tiny.
Yeah.
And it grossed $57 million.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this was, you know, he did so many movies in New York for so long, and then suddenly started discovering Europe, evidently, because he did some in London, then this in Paris, and then there's one in Barcelona, one in Rome.
Nice.
And we're real, I would say, picky about what we see. I mean, you know, we're really just interested in the comedies. But we do kind of read the reviews because he is hit or miss sometimes.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Well, good.
So this is not what I would call one of my favorite, top favorite ones, but I loved Paris. I have a soft spot for Owen Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of casual, laid back style.
Yeah, yeah.
And I loved the overall message, which is live now. I didn't expect that from Woody Allen necessarily. I don't know what I expected from him, but it wasn't this emphasis on we all have this attraction to the past, but you can't live there. It's the present that matters.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was almost science fiction, wasn't it? But it wasn't really.
More fantasy.
Yeah, I think it was more of a fantasy, I guess you'd say, because there's no dwelling on how these things are happening. It's just there and accepted. And yeah, I mean, I thought it was cool.
Yeah.
And so the thing that's happening is, you know, Owen Wilson, who is a writer, is walking around Paris and gets in a car because somebody says, come on, come on. He gets in the car and suddenly is in 1920s Paris. So yeah, it's set in the present day. The movie was made in 2011. So, you know, he goes from 2011 Paris back to 1920s Paris.
Yeah, and he's not very happy with his current life. He would like to be a writer of books, of novels. He has a novel he's finished, and he's a famous or well-paid screenwriter in Hollywood. His fiance does not seem to really be his soulmate.
No.
And they seem pretty mismatched, and her family hates him. They've gone to Paris with her parents, and they're going to do some furniture shopping. I'm like, so, rich parents.
Yeah.
And as they tour around, they also come across an old beau of hers or old friend of hers, I can't remember, who's part of another couple who's very pedantic and likes to tell everybody how much he knows, and it's often wrong. And Owen Wilson is continually squashed when he just tries to be himself. And so when he's sitting there at midnight on this corner and this old car pulls up and he gets in, he's immediately among people who he's always dreamed of meeting. There's Hemingway. There's Gertrude Stein. He's listening to Cole Porter sing, who's one of our favorites, actually, in our household. And he's in the midst of artists and all these various people who are so inspirational, and he's just in seventh heaven. And Gertrude Stein's going to look over his book for him, and he meets this young woman who is his soulmate. And it's funny because he's not obviously obsessed with the past and trying to live there at that point, but he's continually going back to that street corner so he can go back and hear what they think of his novel and go partying with these people at various places, Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And it leads him to not obviously, I guess, look at his current life and see where he's unhappy with his fiance, but you're getting the contrast there.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and he definitely has the feeling that the past was better. You know, this golden age was better than things are now. There was definitely that feeling. And it wasn't only because of his unhappiness in his relationship, which he wasn't confronting. It was almost, he didn't see a lot of things. He was just kind of living his life and trying to do his thing. And he couldn't see that he had a giant obstacle that he was dealing with all the time. But yeah, he did have a strong feeling that the 20s in Paris were a golden age.
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, for whatever reason, he's whisked off there and gets to participate in it. And everybody he meets is somebody that he idolizes.
The way they characterized them was great, because all you have to do is know just enough of the stereotype of these people to be able to identify who they are.
Yeah.
And so Hemingway, evidently a lot of Hemingway fans really objected to the way Hemingway was portrayed in this movie.
Really interesting. He was an intense, the actor, he played him very intense. I mean, when he was on the screen, that he was it. That was like, I am commanding your attention, and I am...
All man needs is courage.
Yeah.
And short, direct sentences.
Right. Just like he writes. So,
but it was kind of how you would imagine all these people, and it didn't matter really that the Hemingway fans who were complaining were completely missing the point.
Mm-hmm.
Of, you know, he didn't get to know these people in depth. That may be how they presented themselves to the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Adrian Brody's, which
Dali.
Artist was he?
Dali. Salvador Dali, yeah.
Brother Rhinoceros.
Dali, don't forget. Dali.
Yes. Yes, Dali.
Mm-hmm.
I draw the rhinoceros. It was just funny.
Yeah.
But continually larded through the movie were these little sentences like, nostalgia is denial of the unpleasant present.
Mm-hmm.
And that's golden age thinking. They were quoting somebody there, but I was like, oh, yeah. And they would talk about, like, Adriana, that's who he is falling in love with in the 1920s. She said, this is the time we live in. Life moves fast and everything is too complicated. Her ideal time is La Belle Époque, which is back when it was Toulouse-Lautrec and Gauguin, Monet, and, you know, I can't remember the name of the place where everybody did the can-can, but so what, the 1890s, 1880s maybe?
Yeah.
She saw the 1920s the way we see it now, and I think that's one of the great gifts of this movie, in addition to the adorable story, is that the past wasn't golden when they were living in it. 50 years in the future, someone may think this is golden for some reason.
Yeah, that was a really pivotal scene where... Adriana is her name, right? They are in the 1890s, and she's explaining to him, no, I live in the 1920s, and this is the golden age.
Right.
1890s are the golden age, not the 20s.
Right.
I live there. Yeah, that was a really profound statement.
And at that very moment, in the Belle Époque, Gauguin says, this generation is empty and has no imagination, not like it was about 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is really being made that everybody thinks the past is great.
Yeah, some past, right?
Well, yeah, not every bit of the past. No one wants to go back to where the plague is.
Sure.
But... it's that idea that, you know, our lives are hard. It was easier back then because we don't see all those little details. And I remember when I was much younger saying something like that to my mother, who looked at me and said, I don't want to go back to the past. And I said, really? She goes, it wasn't that great. There was no air conditioning. There weren't vaccines. She just lists off like five things. She goes, I don't know about the other stuff, but I enjoy air conditioning. And this was at a time when people were kind of speaking slightingly of these kinds of, oh, it's artificial and this. And she goes, yeah, you try trying to sleep through August in Arkansas. Uh-huh.
Yeah,
then see how much you scorn it.
Mm-hmm.
And that really shook me back to that reality, not the way this movie did, where it's making the point in a gentler way. But he has a speech like that, too. After she said, no, this is the golden time. And he goes, no, wait, I don't want to go to the dentist now.
Yeah, right.
I want Novocaine or whatever.
Yeah, he had a dream or something like that. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a lot of that stuff, you know, it's, I mean, our lives are really remarkable today. You know, when you think about that kind of stuff, it's, you know, we continually talk about things like, you know, we're so busy that we don't have time to think. And, you know, wasn't it better in the colonial days when, you know, you just had to plow your field, you know, as if that was just You know, you just had to plow right. your field. Right. And, you know, those folks were busy. Well, they were busy. Yeah, we it's just that they weren't busy in doing the same things.
Yeah. And it's, I think, was it Eisenhower now that you say that about plowing fields? He said, you know, it's one thing to talk about plowing fields. It's another thing to have to go do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talk about that in a very idealized way as if it's old Williamsburg and we're out there watching some guy plowing going, oh, isn't that nice?
Yeah.
When you're doing it, it's hot, dirty work. You're doing it because you hope to have enough to live on through the winter.
Yeah. Yeah. And you need to do it as fast as you can because you have these windows during the year where you've got to get it done. Mm-hmm. And there's always something to do and you're working 14, 15, 20 hours a day.
Yeah.
You know, doing all the stuff that needs to be done just to keep everything running.
Yeah.
And the people that are dependent on you, you know, so there are a lot of negatives, you know, yet, you know, you look at it in an idealized way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, at least we didn't have cell phones or whatever it might be. You know what I mean?
I might not be able to argue with that one, but.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
It is something else now, you know, you get on a train or something, you know, I've been spending a lot of time in Miami and mm-hmm. you are, if you're in a crowd of people and you start to look around, everybody's looking at their phones.
I know.
It's really something else.
We were at NASA when we were in Florida visiting my mother and I looked around. Now, none of the adults were doing this, mm-hmm. but everybody who was a teenage or under, pretty much, when they were at a part that the adults were looking at in rapt fascination about the NASA program, they were all just glued to their phones.
Hmm.
And I was like, I would take your phones away right now. Frankly.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the thing of, you're right here. Look around you.
Yeah, I had a moment like that. We, as a family, we went... Oh, how long ago was this? 15 years, maybe. 15 years ago, we went on a cruise. And this is before cell phones, right? Mm-hmm. So we went on a cruise. So we were in California. So we drove home from California. And, you know, being the dad that I am, I'm thinking, hey, Grand Canyon. So,
oh, yeah.
So we drive to the Grand Canyon on the way home. And we pull up at the Grand Canyon.
Uh-huh.
And one of my kids did not want to get out of the van. Because they were in the middle of a Game Boy game. And I'm like, Grand Canyon. Like, holy cow.
It's
like
the wonders of the world, man, right here.
Yeah, so it's even worse now. It's just like, you know, with the gadgetry and stuff. But
yeah.
It's a different life, isn't it? Yeah.
It is, and I think that's... In a different way, that's what Woody Allen is talking about.
Yeah, I think so, too. It's like, I don't know, there's something about the past. Well, the past is done, right? And hindsight is 20/20,
mm-hmm.
and you can see it for what it is, but, you know, also you're seeing an idealized
right.
version in your head. You know, you're remembering, well, what was good about those last 20 years? Or 20 years ago, my life was good because of... You know, whatever, mm-hmm. you know,
right.
And, you know, maybe that's better than it is now and always questioning yourself and,
yeah,
it's not a good loop to get in, I think is right. what Woody Allen is saying.
Yeah. Because you forget that at that time, I hadn't thought about it in reference to your own life. And that's one of the things that contributes greatly to things like divorce, I think, where it's not, you know, one of those cases where there's abuse or something, so you have to get out of it. And that's most divorce isn't that, let's be frank. And you look back and you think, oh, I remember when we were first in love and it was wonderful and blah, blah, blah. And you want that again. And what you don't realize is that while you're here in this moment, there's so many benefits to having stuck it out, worked through the problems, and there's a different kind of happiness. And C.S. Lewis, and I don't think I have this quote. If I did, I'd be so lucky. But he basically says, you can't look backwards at that stuff because at things like paddling around in a pool when you were a kid and how great that was, he goes, go take swimming lessons. Move on.
Yeah.
You know, do it in a different way. if that's what you want. Well, shoot, I can't find it. But anyway, and so I hadn't thought about it because, you know, even at those times, except for those brief moments, and I can remember being so in love with Tom, and this was after we both discovered we were in love, and it was just so wonderful. And after a while, I was like, this is kind of exhausting. He's the only thing I can think of. And I kind of wanted it to kind of simmer down just a little because I had to work, you know?
Yeah.
And you kind of forget those extremes aren't always good for you either. They're wonderful. And so bad things have happened in your life right now, maybe, that are no fun, but you can still find other satisfying things in your life. Does this make sense?
Yeah, sure it does. I mean, you've got to move forward. Things are different now. You know, have you ever had the experience where you go back to somewhere that you had spent a lot of time and it's not there anymore? You know, it's not ever there anymore.
College or,
like a college is a really good example. Yeah. I went back to the college that I went to, and that is not the place that I went. Just because, you know, so much has changed. It's, you know, they're marching on without me, which is unbelievable.
How dare they?
Yeah. So it's, you know, so when you leave a place and you just can't go back there and expect everything to be exactly like it was. And that's okay. You know, time moves on, things change. I think that's the only constant, you know, there's a quote from somebody, you know, the only constant thing is that things are going to be different.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's good. Sometimes that's bad. You know, sometimes that should make you treasure. If you're really enjoying your life right now, you should really treasure it. Because, you know, time moves on.
Well, and even when times are bad, if you...
Well, that's the opposite. If times are bad, you can count on things. The thing that you can count on, things are going to change. You know, it's not going to be like this all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that and the fact that when times are bad, one of the greatest boons to me as a Catholic is that when times are bad, I have been able to say, honestly, God, I hate this. This is awful. I'm counting on you to show me something good now or later that you can do with this. You know, he didn't make the bad thing happen, but he will take it and do something good with it in my future. And you kind of have to watch it because I remember there's this series of little devotionals. I can't remember if I've mentioned them here, called In Conversation with God. They're just daily devotionals, and the person quotes a lot of Jose Maria Escriva, who's now a saint. And one of the things he said is you have to guard your imagination. I think other saints have said that too, is you have to not live so much in the past or in the future of what you'd like that you're not seeing what God's doing for you right now, whether it's good or bad, in the very boring everyday stuff, in the bad things that happen, or in the good that you can be so thankful for it at that moment. But we're made to live right now. You know, memory's great for, oh, I love these things that happened to me, or I can learn from these things that I wish I'd have done better. You have to have the imagination so you can go to Mars someday or whatever. But you have to live right here. This is where we are.
Right.
And that's hard sometimes.
It is, yeah.
I think that's why I liked this movie so much, because it's really... It's a small movie, and it's entertaining, but it's really kind of just examining that question. And I can't remember if someone said this or if this was just a note I made. I didn't put quotes around it, but at some points I was writing fast, and it said, "It's the present is a little unsatisfying because life is a little unsatisfying." It's usually not every single thing is perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's heaven will be like that. But we're not there.
Right. Yeah. Yep. We are not. That's for sure. That's for sure.
So who would you like to meet? If a car pulled up, no, anybody, if a car pulled up, where would you like it to drive you and who would you like to meet?
Wow. You know, that's tough. One of the things that I learned, I mean, this opened a door for me, this movie, because I don't know much about these folks. And when I looked into it just a little bit, these people were really all in Paris together at the same time.
Isn't that
And they
crazy?
Were meeting at Gertrude Stein's house
yeah.
every Saturday night and talking and doing whatever. And I just find that really exciting. So I think that, you know, apart from like going all the way back to Christ.
Oh, well, which yes, is discounting Jesus.
The easy answer for everything.
Yeah.
But it always blows me away who was alive during World War II.
All
the people that were, I mean, we're talking about writers, artists, scientists, politicians, you know, all the, there's so many people that I would love to meet from the 40s. So, I don't know, 1938, maybe, right before it all happened. but
yeah.
there's probably, you know, those people, a lot of them didn't come to light until after the war was happening.
Yeah, but the exciting thing is you know them then, because that's the whole thing about Owen Wilson's character is none of those people, they were all struggling too.
Mm-hmm.
They were, none of them were necessarily
he met Hemingway,
famous
and
at
Hemingway
the time.
Had written a book at that point.
Yeah, none of them were famous at the time. And so he also shows them at a time when they, everything is uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing we forget all those times in life. It's that thing of life is a little unsatisfying. Well, life is also uncertain.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it makes me think of one of the books we listened to on the way to Florida was Malcolm Gladwell's new book, which is David and Goliath.
Mm-hmm.
And he's taking all these different situations of the little guy versus the big guy, how we always kind of expect that might is going to win, might is right, or might has all the resources. And David and Goliath is the easy shorthand for that. And then he will take those situations and show how either we're not looking at it properly, that the little guy has advantages we're just not thinking about, or that the disadvantages that somebody has to work to overcome is what helps make them great and makes them win in a situation where you'd expect the big guy to win. And he took, as an example, the Impressionists, Manet, Monet, Van Gogh, all these various people, Pissarro, who I happen to know about a little, in that they kept trying to get into the Salon. And the Salon was this very closed, selective group that every year would have a huge show, and you had to paint your paintings to all these various criteria. They would then accept hundreds of paintings, and thousands of people would go to this month-long show in this huge building where there'd be four rows up to the sky of different paintings. The ones that were their favorites were eye level. The ones they liked least were called skylined. They were up on the top, so you couldn't really see them. And they kept submitting their paintings, these Impressionists, and trying to get in. One year, one of them got in. I think it was Manet. And his painting was so extreme, it made people faint, literally. And so they took him off the wall and put him in a back room. And so they had these huge arguments all the time in their favorite cafe about, do we have our own show or do we keep trying to get into the establishment? And they'd be divided, and they'd write each other letters about it, and there were huge arguments. Finally, they decided to have their own show, and they rented these rooms and showed 139 paintings, and they were all at eye level and properly displayed so you could see them. And the first day, 139 people came, and they were like, it's a win! People actually came to see our paintings. And they said, now if you looked back, the value of the paintings in that room would be $10 million.
Hmm.
At the time, you could buy them for a few francs because they weren't selling anywhere. And so he was talking about, now we look back, of course they're wonderful. But then life was so uncertain. They didn't know what to do themselves. They were trying and trying and trying to figure out how do they show their view of how you can do art to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same as those people that were shown back in 1920s Paris. And that's why maybe we like to look back and go, oh, it was settled. We know these people were great. Well, now we don't know how we'll be remembered or the people around us will be remembered. We're just trying. We're blind because everyone is at the time.
Yeah.
So how do you live your life that way? And you have to have, you have to, of course, try the best you can. But you have to have ultimate trust that even if you're never remembered but for something like that, you make a difference with all the people whose lives you touch.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's why the lives of the saints are the same way. I mean,
yeah,
when we see their lives as a whole, we say, oh, that person's a saint, but that person struggled and was not always mm-hmm. Was not always a saint.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's something that's just amazing to think about, because we're all going through stuff, and that's the value of looking at the lives of the saints.
Well, and we're all supposed to be saints. That's why we're here.
Mm-hmm.
This is our maturing ground to learn how to give ourselves to God so we can give ourselves to other people. And if I think of the future and I think of somebody 50 years from now going, oh, well, St. Julie or St. Scott, thanks to this podcast or something, something else, maybe. On the one hand, it sounds ludicrous, but on the other hand, I'm like, could that happen? Well, only if I try as hard as I can. I mean, my grandfather, everybody who ever knew him he was a saint. He's just an unsung saint, except by all of us who all remember him and how wonderful he was. And he's one of my models for life. He and my grandmother. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a road. It's not a place. It's a road.
Yeah.
Right. And so we all have a long way to go.
Right. But that's what we have to try to do now is continually, we've got these models and we try to live up to it.
Yeah.
And thank goodness for Christ, because, I can't do this by myself. I have to be remade.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was really interesting to look into all of that. So what about yourself? What time would you go back to?
Oh, well, this might be indicated by a lot of my recent reading. I would go straight to, what is it called? The Eagle and something. And see if I could sit in with the Inklings and J.R.R. Tolkien, Charles Williams, C.S. Mm-hmm. Lewis.
Yeah.
And maybe I could hear them reading some of their unfinished books,
Heck yeah. A group like that would be so valuable. I mean, I can just imagine just keeping you kind of on task and giving you some immediate purpose, to bring something to that group. And so I can see, and people do writers groups all the time, but there just seems to be something special about these, that group in Paris and that group at the Inklings.
Mm-hmm.
It's like magic, really something.
Well, it's interesting because I asked my husband, who doesn't care about artists or writers like that generally, who he would meet. And he has done a lot of work on Ancestry.com, just tracking family trees.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, there was a John Davis in Virginia in the late 1700s who actually was at Valley Forge. I would like to meet him. And I thought, I hadn't thought of ancestors.
Uh-huh.
And because he was tracing the kid's family line, lucky me, he did me too then. I said, there was I think his name was John Austin, and that's my father's, that was my maiden name,
mm-hmm.
who right after the Pilgrims came to Plymouth Rock, within about 10 or 15 years, he came over. Evidently, this guy's got like 5 million ancestors. So if there's an ancestor, a descendant listening, hi, cousin. But my husband said, he can trace him. He goes, he can't get the documentation to prove that that's my father's family line. But he's like, it's so matches up that's where your family came from on that side. And I'm like, I would love to know what made him so desperate that he did that, or so hopeful, or was he a scoundrel, or what made him take a daring change in his life? Like that.
Yeah. 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 I've got a few pictures of my grandfather who I named my daughter after, in New York City in the 1930s. And I've often thought, man, I would just love to go meet him at that age. Yeah. I've got a photo where, I was doing some stuff on ancestry.com, poking around in there. And somehow I got connected to another person who had photographs uploaded. And I was flipping through them, and I'm like, holy cow, that's my grandpa right there.
Isn't that neat? It was when that neat. Happens.
Yeah. So he was there with his brother and just a group of guys that looked like they were having a really good time. I was like, oh man, that'd be fun to go meet him.
Oh, back then.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't want to stay in those times. I was thinking about what time period would you go back to? And I guess I've absorbed that message really well through a variety of reasons. I'm like, I think I would pick now.
Yeah. And there's no, I mean, we've got, no, I agree with you 100% because now is where I live. Right. And I've got kids and all this stuff. Right. I really wouldn't want to be anywhere else. But yeah. Yeah. There are some people I'd like to meet.
Yes. I might get in the car a couple of times.
Yeah. As long as they bring you back. So, but yeah.
So that's,
Yeah. So the movie, I really did enjoy it. I have no idea if this is typical Woody Allen, but if it is, I got a lot of nice viewing ahead of me. I enjoyed the relationships he set up too. You know, Owen Wilson and his fiance, that was an interesting, you know, and the dialogue is great. The actors were really good.
That sort of thing was really typical for him.
The
way they speak, and the, especially like the family dynamic was very typical. And Owen Wilson is essentially playing Woody Allen's character. Somebody's always Woody Allen in a movie if he's not in it. So he was essentially playing the Woody Allen character, you know. And I'm going to have to send you I'll put some on the post.
Yeah, please do.
Because there's some other movies that are great too. It's just these happen to be my favorites and these other ones I mentioned.
Yeah.
But he writes a certain kind of a movie, and I don't usually like his serious ones as much because he's not afraid to make you really sad. But recently somebody had chosen for the movie growing, movie viewing group at Carruth Haven, Blue Jasmine. And we watched it because of it was nominated for an Oscar for Cate Blanchett, which she actually won. And it was a serious one, which I usually would have avoided. And it was really a great movie. As a character study, it was amazing. And also, as a championing of the working class, which I really don't expect in this way, it was fascinating. You know?
Yeah.
And I could highly recommend that, too. I don't think I would want to watch it again, unless, you know, you wanted to watch it and talk about it. That's different. But I'm not sorry I watched it. And a lot of times with his movies, I'm kind of guarding myself against unpleasantness for the serious ones, just because I, you know, I'd rather not watch a serious movie sometimes. Yeah. But.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting. So, but yes, loved it. So anyway, thanks very much. It opened up a couple of doors. So I have, you know, Woody Allen and then this whole, group of people in the 20s. You know, F. Scott Fitzgerald and Zelda Fitzgerald, I looked them up a little bit too, and fascinating. Tragic end. I don't know if you know much about them, but Zelda was she had some mental issues.
Yeah, ended she up committed in an asylum. Suicide.
Well, she ended up in an asylum that and died there because of a fire.
Okay.
It was in North Carolina.
Yeah. Wow, right.
I stumbled on a NPR story, and I'll put that in the show notes.
Okay.
But it was just an NPR story. It was about 7 minutes long that talked about Asheville, North Carolina, and the Fitzgeralds. Yeah, so that's where she died.
And I've never read anything by F. Scott Fitzgerald. I've, you know, a couple times picked something up and gone, I don't care about this at all.
Yeah.
And I was writing
The subject matter is not something that I'm just all over. And I've never read one either. I've read some Hemingway. I've never read anything by Gertrude Stein. In fact, I've heard the name, but I had no idea who she was.
I know of her because of Alice B. Toklas, who was her companion. Uh-huh. Companion. And so she wrote a cookbook. And so I had read her cookbook. And so she would just talk about Gertrude casually in passing because of that. And that's when I finally twigged to the fact that, oh, she's famous. Oh, okay. Because they were every so often she'd mention, oh, so-and-so came over. But it wasn't really a name-dropping thing. It was really a cookbook just kind of strung together with, like, you know, oh, well, the Germans were coming. And so we went and lent our car to the whatever procession of people leaving or trying to take supplies somewhere, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, but she was supposedly very shy, so.
Yeah, yeah. And then the artists as well. I'm not big on art, and I don't know a lot of artists, but Picasso was there, and yeah, very interesting.
No, I'm trying to think of why we both knew something so much about these impressionists. We must have read or heard something. Now I'm going to have to ask my husband, and if I find it, I'll put a link to it, because both of us were like, well, of course we know this. Okay, so it'll be interesting to hear what he does with it.
Yeah, yeah. Very cool. So anyway, thank you very much.
No, you're welcome very much. I'm glad you liked it.
Enjoyed. So cool. So what do we got next here?
Next is also something light.
Yes.
Short.
Agent to the Stars by Mr. John Scalzi.
Yes.
Yep. Cool. And I've started the audiobook.
Will Wheaton.
Read by Will Wheaton. I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, he's really good at this one anyway.
Uh-huh. Cool.
I haven't heard any of his others, but he really does a good job.
Good deal.
And this is, it's light and humorous, but yet touches on some big topics, I think.
Oh, good.
So it'll be interesting to talk about.
All right. Fantastic.
Yeah.
So I need to get busy and do some picking.
Yeah, I was going to say, then we have nothing. There's the vast chasm ahead of us.
Right.
Kind of terrifying.
Well, I'll get that done this week. We'll get those picked.
Good.
Looks like I have three in a row, don't I?
Oh, yeah, because a religious movie is coming up.
Right, the religious movie is what I'm trying to pick. And I'm like, what constitutes a religious movie?
I don't know, because one time I was going to pick a book to read for the religious thing, and you went, that's fiction. And I went, oh, I didn't
have nonfiction. That's too good.
Cool. I guess I think of a religious movie as made specifically to talk about religious things.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to the ones we talk about, which may touch on them quite a lot, but they're not specifically trying to get that point across. But that doesn't have to be the case, I suppose.
Okay.
Because something like Babette's Feast.
Uh-huh. The Song of Bernadette.
It's a beautiful story, and it's definitely religious. That's the point of it. But I think it was just made because the story was there.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
How about like the Song of Bernadette?
Oh, yeah.
Or A Man for All Seasons. Is A Man for All Seasons a religious movie?
Well, yeah, because it's about martyr.
Yeah, I agree.
Isn't that Thomas More?
It is, yeah.
And
it's a very, very good movie. Maybe I'll pick that.
Well, I've always heard it's good. I've never seen it. But I've always meant to. But
well, there. Let's pick that.
I just love him. She's so practical. Easy enough, everyone.
Yeah, easy enough. But, is that a... it's about a saint and everything, so...
Well, and it's a movie that everybody says is so great.
Well,
and
it is a good movie, yeah.
There's something about Thomas More that who wouldn't love him? He had a great sense of humor, very practical, immersed in politics and the world he was in with big family. He just... And everything I've ever read that he wrote, which are just quotes, not, any of his books or anything, but he was so relatable. He's so normal seeming, you know?
Yeah. All right, great. Well, I'm going to pick that, if that's all right with you.
Oh, definitely.
And then I will get busy on the other two.
I'm excited.
Well, good.
I'm writing that down. I'm so excited. It's going on a list.
Fantastic, fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Well, we'll see in a couple of weeks.
Ideas for religious movies, definitely.
Yeah, please do.
Let us know.
Please do let us know.
Let us know. Yeah. Yes. Sorry, I cut you off.
No, that's fine.
Yeah, so we'll see
everybody
in a couple of weeks.
All right.
All right.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.